Hello and welcome to this special Beyond Shakespeare discussion on the work of John Heywood, specifically via the frame of a new book by Professor Greg Walker, a Regius Professor of Rhetoric and English Literature at the University of Edinburgh, who has written a fantastic volume on the life and work of John Heywood called John Heywood, Comedy and Survival in Tudor England. It is a very comprehensive coverage of all of Heywood's life and work, perhaps more emphasis is, it's easier to emphasize work because we have so much more of it, but also covering the context and history of why these plays, songs, epic poems, and other works came into being. And I'm delighted to have with me Professor Greg Walker to talk about his book and the journey that it has come to come into being. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Robert. Good to hear you again, and indeed to see you this time, which is quite exciting.
Yes. Last listeners to the podcast will know we did almost a 2-hour interview with examples on the work of John Heywood, which was released about a year and a half ago on and off. It was recorded probably, I think, much earlier than that as well. So there's a lot of lot to say about Heywood. I read the book. I think it's a fantastic volume. Tell me about the process of how books come about, how a book like this comes about, how you come to write it. I assume it's coming out of your other books about Tudor court drama that you have produced over time and your other researches.
You're very kind, Robert. It is a very big book, a book that ought not really to be as big as it is, probably. But I mean, I have found Heywood endlessly fascinating since the late 80s, really. So this was the huge scratch at the itch that needed scratching. And once you start, it is very, very difficult to stop, because I wanted to do what most books and things on Heywood have not really done in the past, which is to look at all of it and to look at all of it with equal focus. So if there's a small poem out there, then I'll look at it carefully, just as I looked at the plays and The Spider and the Fly. I mean, I did it so no one else has to. It is a long process. I mean, thankfully, I got a grant from those wonderful people at the Leverhulme Trust to spend 2 years on it, which got most of it done. So it was quite a long journey. But I mean, I just love Heywood. So it was it had to be done.
Yes, I mean, even his collected plays does not have all of his plays in one volume, which is that, you know, the Gentleness and Nobility is sort of appended to the Rastall plays in that series. So it's slightly frustrating. You can't even pick up one book of Heywood for his material, which is a great shame.
It is. I mean, in defence of Richard Axton, he got in there first, so claimed it for Rastall. Mm. And there is still a case to be made who wrote it. I mean, I'm making the case that Heywood probably wrote most of it with Rastall's collaboration. Mm. But, you know, that's only as strong as the next attack on the process. You know, someone can come along and say, oh, but it was all written by Thomas More or Margaret or someone like that. Mm. So, but it is frustrating. Yes, you cannot get the collected Heywood. Mm.
Talking about different responses to not just authorship but also where things live, you've made quite a good assault on where the various plays that Heywood wrote live, you know, they are, broadly speaking, I don't think there are different opinions as to where certain texts live. So, you know, if you listen to the podcast at the moment, in our playlist, the first one you would listen to is Witty and Witless, followed by John and his wife, Sir John the Priest and his wife Table, whichever way around that title goes. Mm. But you make a good case for the reverse.
Well, I mean, that was always a coin flip, really, wasn't it? I mean, I agree that they look very much like the earliest of the material that we have. One is to some extent original, the other one a translation. They both look like early work, a writer writing for an audience and probably a company he knows quite well. So it seems safe to place it in Rustell's family circle and that stage at Finsbury Fields. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to die on the ditch of which in which order those two go, but I mean, I think they are Hayward learning his trade. I mean, it would be good to find other French translations or translations from the French as well to suggest he was doing more than just these two kind of slightly remarkable first goes. But I'll happily argue.
Well, exactly. I mean, I have to say, my heart sank a little bit when I picked up my first volume of British drama, the catalogue by Wiggins, and placing Witty and Witless in the 1540s, and I sort of went, based on a reasonable proposition at the ending of Witty and Witless, and elements of it could have been rewritten later in its life.
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly true. I mean, the problem that Wiggins presents is it's got that bit about Will Sommer in it. Mm. And for a while, everyone was comfortable with the idea that Will Sommer was at court in the 1520s. And then one of the vital pieces of evidence was redated to the mid-1530s. So, oh dear, we can't have an early Witty and Witless. But clearly it was rewritten. I mean, literally it was rewritten, because there's that entry that says, don't read these last four staves unless the king's present. So there's an element of contingency. And my guess is that that was added later. We don't know, of course, because it's not an authorial manuscript. It's a later copy. So whether that was kind of tacked on at the end or was always going to be detached if the king wasn't there.
It's interesting.
And its language is very much the language of the early 1530s, I think. It's a language that says, yes, we're stuck with the supremacy in the Church of England, but we don't like the way it's being used at the moment, so we'd like you to rein it in a bit.
Well, there's so much contingency with all the plays that we get, certainly plays Rastel's Four Elements, which we looked at recently, where, you know, opens with all these contingencies. You know, yes. You can drop this speech, you can drop that bit. And he's got a good point. They are excessively long speeches that Rastel puts in.
But I like his kind of humility. I mean, the fact that, oh yeah, put a dance in if you want, you know, take this stuff out if it doesn't work, kill someone at the third act if they're getting bored. It's a kind of professional piece of work, isn't it? It's saying, I know what will happen to this script and feel free to do it.
And, you know, thinking that these plays are all coming around in, you know, within a stage that Rastel has constructed in the 1520s, that Hayward is presumably working towards that space, that there is a mini theatre circle that has a practice that we can glimpse at.
It must inform his work, I think. I mean, whether everything was literally written to be performed on that stage is probably a step beyond the evidence we have, but it must be informed by the practice of that little company based on Rastel's family. And he is a much more important figure than most accounts have allowed, I think, precisely because there is that little theatre community living there from the very early period, from the 1520s. And he's printing the things he's not playing, you know. So he's in there at every level.
And you know that there is a circle, a wider intellectual circle around that as well, because obviously everyone's always very interested in Thomas More, and the intellectual life and the arguments that these writers in the 1520s at least are writing from, reformist but still definitely Catholic school of thought. I mean, they are, you know, pre the problem of the problems that the Reformation are going to show into sharp relief, as it were.
I mean, it's like it's the classic liberals on the cusp of revolution thing. You know, they're working hard to make the system better and to make it work. They see what's wrong, and they have a set of rational reforms, and then the juggernaut that is the Russian Revolution, or Henry VIII's Reformation kind of chugs in and wipes the architecture out, and they're left thinking, well, WTF, you know, what do we do now? How do we get back to the ideals that we had in this new landscape? A little bit like we're living through now.
Yes, we have all this activity happening in quite a short period of time. So all these plays by Heywood, and also the activity of Rastall's press, John Rastall at least, is all happening in the late 1520s, early 1530s. And there's just so much activity happening that it really is just everything's hugger-mugger.
So that was one of the great things about doing the research for the book. You keep looking at these things, and just a couple of vital years seem to have been the wellspring of all this activity. I mean, and particularly the summoning of the Reformation Parliament and the fall of Wolsey, opening up the prospect for a humanist program of reform. I mean, Heywood seems to have been genuinely excited by that, Rastall still more so. And then they have the opportunity to put it into practice when Thomas More is appointed Lord Chancellor unexpectedly, you know, out of a clear blue sky. Suddenly, you know, they have their uncle, their brother-in-law, in Parliament as Chancellor, so you can actually do things. And then the juggernaut knocks the front door down, and he's trying to get it out again, putting out fires, and that hope turns into a kind of satirical rearguard action, I think. They begin to write about how you survive rather than how you reform.
So the juggernauts on the horizon. Next in your data, you've got the 4P's, depending on 4PP as printed. Into what I still find is my personal favourite, gentleness and nobility, and just the certainly in terms of gentleness and nobility, which is a play we keep almost staging. Events keep over taking us. We've essayed it, we've workshopped it, we've done the audio version, but we've never quite managed to get further. But especially with gentleness and nobility, of explicitly trying to talk about the ability to reform and or the inability to reform, and the question of which writer is more optimistic and which is more pessimistic.
I mean, essentially, you've got a play that is burning with a reforming ambition. You know, it says, look at the way our society is. You know, you wouldn't set a world like this, would you? In which the aristocracy and the wealthy simply ride roughshod over the productive classes. The ploughman speaks for a kind of utopian vision of social reform. But the play says, well, you know, we know what the world is like. It's never going to be achieved. It's, you know, the landowners and the merchants have got all the power. And no matter how convincing the argument, they're still going to lose. There's two of them, and there's one of the ploughmen, and he will lose. And the play kind of ends on this rather sour note. But then you have the epilogue when on comes the philosopher and says, now, just wait a minute. Let's look at that again. And then you suddenly have this optimism. And my sense is that sounds more like Rastall than Heywood. But it also sounds more like people who know that their brother-in-law and their uncle is just about to open a parliament, which is deliberately and openly called to reform abuses. And they suddenly think, well, maybe there's a chance. Maybe we can do these kind of things now. So I think it's both two different temperaments, but also a very particular moment when that possibility suddenly becomes a bit more possible, and the cynicism steps back for a moment and says, okay, well, let's give it a go. And you can see that in other writing of the period as well, of that late 1528, 1529, there's a sense that Parliament is going to be where something happens for once. Whereas previously, you know, Parliament is the place where you go and talk for 6 months and then go home. And you have, the king has got his money.
The text could be, you know, talking quite directly to someone that they know, who is now in a position of power. As a spur, perhaps? Is that the sort of the suggestion you're making that? The question about, you know, what relationship drama and literature has in terms of talking to power is something you've explored quite a lot in your work. And it happens in a lot of our read-throughs is where people are saying, you wouldn't present this in front of the king or the queen, would you? And you're going, well, no, the relationship is quite different. Could you sort of expand on that?
Yeah, well, I think it that notion of counsel, you know, that literature is a moral force, had a lot of value. That Erasmian sense that, you know, good princes listen when you tell them what's wrong. There's that model going on. And so a lot of Heywood's work, I think, is writing truth to power in a loyalist way. You know, your majesty is an idiot, but I love you, is the kind of subtext throughout his career. But here, I think it's also counsel to more. I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, the Moore circle is seen as being quite unified mostly, and, you know, to speak with one voice. But that, to me, gentleness and nobility looks like Heywood and Rustell saying, you know, you've talked the talk, Tom. Now you've got the chance to actually do this. Don't screw it up. Don't make the usual compromises. Still believe in these things, you know, or you're going to be on the side of the landowners and the merchants. And we all know that's wrong, isn't it? Remember Utopia. On you go.
As the years progress, we reach the early 1530s, and Play of Love, which is another one on the list of to-do lists, because I think it's an absolutely lovely, a fascinating play. I think there's a lot to be gripped with it. Obviously, our aspect is always again the modern era, but you again look at what it's saying to the time, and around about here we've had Wolsey's fall, and for those historians at home can remember as far back as Wolf Hall Volume 1, we're about there.
Yep. I mean, one of the things with Heywood's plays is they all inhabit a particular cultural niche. I mean, this is his legal play, I think. This is the one that deals with pleading before a judge most explicitly. I mean, they're all kind of debate plays, but this is the one about legal process, and it's a joke about what lawyers do. And it looked, again, to me to come very much out of that moment at the very end of the 1520s, where Wolsey has either just fallen or is just about to fall. And so, because there's a parody of him in the play. I mean, there's a very brief kind of pastiche where the vice figure does a Wolsey for about 20 lines. Mm. And it's all about, you know, they play with conscience, for instance, which is a key term for the conscience courts of Star Chamber and Chancery. And it's all about, you know, how do you argue your way when your client is a complete, obviously a loser? And so you have these preposterous cases. Who is most in love? Who is most happy? Who is least happy? And they argue their way round and round because there's no right answer. And it's all about process. But it's also all about what conscience really means, I think. And it seems to me that that's exactly the thing you would remind Thomas More of when he's about to become the head of the courts of conscience. What does your conscience tell you to do? Don't just use it as an excuse. Actually work on the real conscience. Mm. And Heywood often plays with words like that. So this is the conscience play. Throughout the 1530s, he's using other words. Merriness becomes a kind of leitmotif for him. And they're all very heavily freighted words in a particular political context.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting when you're talking about that little scene where he does his Wolsey impression. I remember when we were producing our version of just going, why is this happening? And it's very useful data to know going forward of going, right, okay, we are empowered to do something with this because we know it's, there is no chance the audience will understand the original context unless we, you know, ram it home with extended extra textual material to really
short lecture with Blackburn.
Yeah. You know, Brief interlude to see Wolsey's fall.
Yes. Meanwhile, at Hampton Court.
Yes.
That's the thing with Hayward. They are very, very much plays of the moment, poems of the moment. And once that moment is gone, they look weird. Because you don't feel the pressure that his audiences would have felt with, ooh, really? He said that? You know, it suddenly becomes quite fraught for a moment. And then he steps back. The classic thing is, you know, he does that jesting thing, which is to risk offence, push it really close to the edge, and then step back and say, only joking. But he said it, and then it's in the room, and, you know, it acknowledges something, which is his real gift, I think.
Well, we are rapidly running out of plays in this little journey. And you sort of place next Play About the Weather, at least its initial formation, next in the sort of early 1530s, though potentially for a later actual performance or a later repeat performance.
This is the one that, you know, I try and make sense of it, because it doesn't make sense in some ways. I mean, there's a lot in the play about the opening of a parliament, which clearly to me makes sense only in 1529, when the parliament is just opened. And that whole opening speech by Jupiter is a pastiche, an evocation of the opening of the Reformation parliament. You know, we're here to reform abuses, great enormities. You know, these are words which just kind of literally borrow from More's opening speech to Parliament. So that makes sense in 1529, I think. But then you have all the kind of bawdy stuff about Anne Boleyn, hints about secret marriages and leaky women who have been discarded in favour of whatever the opposite of leaky is, watertight women. And there's this kind of misogynistic laughter about, you know, the king's peccadilloes, which really only makes sense in 1522, 1523, when Henry has kind of publicly declared that he is now happily in a relationship with Anne Boleyn, although it's not public yet. So you can joke about that. I think 2 years before, you couldn't joke about the king being unhappy with his wife because it was an ongoing issue. And so one way of making sense of those two different debates almost is to think about it being rewritten for performance at a later time. You could argue the whole thing was written in 1532, 33, but then who's going to remember jokes about words used in the opening of the Parliament 3 years before, 4 years before? So I think given Hayward's capacity to be writing always of the moment and for the moment, it looks like two moments in one text.
Yes, because it's you manage therefore to make a sort of weather sandwich of Pardoner and the Friar, and in a much later date than I've thought about it in the past. But I think you make a very good case. Make your case for the placement of Pardoner and the Friar in the around 1532.
Well, again, if I'm right, and you know, who knows whether I am or not, there was clearly a kind of brief cause celebre, so brief it was almost instantly forgotten, about two clerics fighting in a church in London, drawing blood, and then being forced to do penance publicly. And this was a kind of public moment. There's one chronicle that mentions it twice, and it says, there was these friars, and they drew blood, and the church was closed. It was awful. And then comes back and says, remember those friars? They had to do penance. It was like this. They went here and there. And John Stowe mentions it and says, yes, and they walked all the way through London in shifts, and it was really interesting. But, you know, a very small moment. But when Hayward starts to write a play about two clerics arguing in a church who then draw blood, it begins again to look like hanging a particular kind of play on a particular moment that everyone is going to prick up their ears and say, oh, right, okay. And he leads up to it so carefully. You know, you have this kind of deft Chaucerian satire. You have this brilliant kind of divisive technique of having the two actors talk over each other. You know, all that kind of careful modulation of voice. And then it becomes clear that they're in a church, and the priest comes in and says, what are you doing in my church? You're polluting it. Hope there's no bloodshed. Hint, hint. And they then have a fight, and then there is some bloodshed. And then they all, the villains wander off saying, ha ha, we'll be back. And it looks like Hayward really thinking, you know, this is how far we've gone in kind of religious reform, where you can have debates between priests in churches that end in bloodshed.
Mm. And, you know, compare that with the what he's writing just, you know, 4 or 5 years earlier, where you have, you know, quite reasonably measured. I mean, gentleness and nobility does involve a certain amount of beating, but it's a much more bold piece of work, and I like placing it where you've placed it. I think that actually makes an awful lot of sense
You know, he's a playwright that now knows that he can push things formally as well as tonally. You know, this is his angry heavy metal moment. You know, he thinks, let's untune our instruments and go for disharmony for a while and see what the audience think of that.
Mm. Well, it's as I've said this before, it is the most theatrical play. In terms of, it only works in the theatre. You know, I'm relatively happy with the audio version we produced, but it is impossible to reproduce the effect of this in a different medium. It only works as a piece of theatre, because it's about the competition of attention, and then the breakdown and the gameplay that performers would be engaging in, and you know, these are games between performers.
And I think if we go with that idea of the company, you know, having a fairly established group of actors at the core of what he does, then you know he now trusts them to the point where they can do that. It's not, oh, you know, actor A, make your point. Actor B, make your point. Actor A, rebut that point. It's, you know, go for it, compete. Argue from different sides of the stage. You know, use your props. It's really, I'd love to see it.
Well, I mean, the one nice thing about it is it does present a get out clause for how many lines you need to learn, because there is an intimation that they have a text that they want to deliver in the space. So it's only the dynamic interplay between them. The long speeches could be cheated in quite a quick time.
Yes. Yes.
Which makes its practical production much, much easier, because I don't know the kind of pain that it would require to learn those speeches and learn and remember where your cues in terms of staying in time with the other person. It's hard enough doing it. We have tested it to some degree when you're reading it.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting, yeah. I mean, it's also very visual, I guess. You know, the pardoner has his papal paraphernalia,
and he gets a stool.
Yes,
he gets to be physically higher,
and he can wave his bull about and these kind of things. Whereas, presumably, the friar has his Bible.
Mm.
So there's kind of, you know, there's a kind of physical regrounding every time you pat your Bible and shout and wave your arms about, presumably that gives it a structure for the actors too, potentially.
So we've hit the 15:33-ish, and even if it's not the end of Hayward's theatrical career, the sort of breakup of his circle of friends and his access to performance space to some degree, because the Restalls' religious leanings shift in complicated and potentially painful. One of the things I really liked about your book is actually sketching out their lives and the shape of their lives and John Restall's life. You know, there's something very sad about, I mean, there's always something very sad about when you look at somebody's journey of their life, because inevitably somebody's life story ends in their death. But there's something particularly sad about John Restall and the shape of his life. And
doubly sad because it's almost comic. I mean, he doesn't have the dignity of tragedy. He dies failing for the wrong cause, dies in prison for seemingly having argued about religious taxes that no one was interested in, having tried to convert Was it the Carthusians? I can never remember. I mean,
Yeah, I think it was.
and
they
the
just laughed at
Tabernacle.
him.
Yes, and the most extreme bunch of ultra-Catholic future martyrs. He tries to convert to Protestantism by natural reason, having already tried to convert John Frith to Catholicism and inadvertently converting himself to Protestantism in the process. I mean, it's hard not to. You know, he tried to discover the New World and ended up lost in Ireland. I mean, this is a man who had enormous energy, intellectual energy, entrepreneurial energy. You know, he was always pushing things and always tripping over his own feet. And, you know, clearly lost touch with his family, split with Moore, split with his sons, and died, you know, complaining that he had no friends and no one would come and visit him. It's a terrible, you know, imagine another world in which he had been still at the center of things in the 1530s, and it would have been tremendously exciting.
So that's John Rastall. His son William, I think that's the way around, isn't it? He
it.
Remains Catholic and remains a printer, and is keeping Heywood's literary career going to some degree. So we know that Heywood is still doing some kind of performance, but he's no longer centrally at court in the way that he was.
It looks that way, yeah. I mean, William Heywood printed all of Heywood's plays that we know about, and we know about them largely because Rastall printed them. And he did that in 1533, 1534, and then he himself stopped printing because Cromwell lent on him, and he wisely decided that a career in the law offered a safer option. So then, yeah, Heywood doesn't have a printer to publish anything. He doesn't have his father-in-law's stage to go and perform on anymore. So he sort of disappears from the record to some extent, but then resurfaces as a musician, a choir master, possibly, certainly as a singing man, associated with St. Paul's Cathedral, although never formally employed by them. And then you see this rather kind of odd career where he occasionally is called to do performances at court, often with children's companies, but he's also writing songs and composing music and acting as a teacher in one form or another. And that's kind of Heywood phase Mark II. The reboot of Heywood is, you know, this time I'm a musician and it's really cool. But he's still doing the same things. You know, he's still worried about authority and power and community. And he's still very much an Erasmian reformist Catholic, worried about what's happening to Uncle Thomas and, you know, Moore's persecution, his resignation. It's there. Once you start looking at those songs, they're really troubling, I think.
Yes, because you mentioned earlier talking about merriness and use of loaded words, which you talk about in your discussion of his various lyrics that survive in the Redford book. Which you know, we've just been reading Wit and Science, so which is a fabulous play, by the way.
Wonderful.
It's got one of my favourite bits of comedy business with Ignorance, is just glorious. We're going to workshop that hopefully soon. But yeah, a manuscript with all sorts of bits and pieces, some Heywood, some various other people's, and. So yes, this pointed use of language and specific words that's going on.
Yeah, I mean that book looks very much like a Catholic, not resistance, but I mean a kind of repository of Catholic thought and entertainment. You know, these songs are all written by people who would resist the Reformation in one form or another. And Heywood's work is pretty central to the book, along with Redford's. And on one level, they're all pretty trite. They're always kind of, let's be merry, let's be cheerful, let's not look back. Always look on the bright side of life, ho-hum, those kind of sentiments. But then when you compare that to what was actually happening in the political world, the same kinds of language recurs, but in a much more serious context. So one of Thomas More's key tropes was always to say, yes, you're persecuting me now, but we'll all be merry together in heaven, won't we? So, you know, implication, there's a wider perspective here that makes all of this worldly stuff foolish. So why don't we stop? And he turned on his judges at the end of his own trial when he'd been condemned to death and said, you condemn me now, but like the saints in heaven, we will all be friends. And St. Paul, St. Stephen? I think, you know, St. Paul was on the judging panel that condemned St. Stephen to death, but now they're friends merrily in heaven. So when Hayward keeps saying, let's be merry, St. Paul told us to be merry. You know, there's that cutting edge to it. It's saying community, decent values, remember the wider perspective of heaven.
And so he's dancing around writing this. He's producing music. He's occasionally producing bits of work, even under Edward. Mm-hmm. There's something really interesting about how people are on very different wavelengths to the ruling monarch are still producing work for them. You've written about Udall as well, I think, in under Mary, who, you know, there seems to be this weird contrast that seems to happen.
I mean, that's in a way why the word survival's in the book title. You know, how do you survive when you're on this roller coaster of religious change, you know, one monarch extreme Protestant, the next Catholic? How can you be consistently yourself in that environment without withdrawing from politics? And I think one of the answers is fear. Obviously, you know, are they just cowards, time servers? I don't think that's true. I think that notion that, you know, what do you do when the monarch is wrong? You counsel them, you know, you snuggle closer to them and say, are you sure, Your Majesty? Isn't this a bit ridiculous, Your Honour? And so Hayward would perform plays for people who were extremely opposed to him. So a play for Cromwell, a play for Cranmer. And he was clearly very popular at Edward's court. You know, a lot of stories and anecdotes about him being favoured and being looked after and teasing the Earl of Northumberland when he was protector. You know, he was a celebrity in this period.
Well, he's also becomes writes what will be perhaps become his most famous works in his lifetime and just beyond of all his various proverbs and and a the material epigram. There.
We can see a rock in the road that produces these, I think, which is, you know, the terrible events at the end of 1542 when he was condemned to death, when clearly the dancing about and the joking stopped for a minute and he was asked, what do you say to the claim that the king is head of the Church of England? And for a period, it looks as if he could not agree with that and wouldn't, you know, like more, go on record as taking the oath, and was imprisoned, condemned to death, but then recanted. And it seems to, for at least a period after that, that he was keeping his head down, not trying to write things that were overtly controversial. So he began to collect epigrams and proverbs and to produce these brilliant kind of ruminations on what a proverb is and these kind of rib-ticklingly funny, allegedly, collections of humorous proverbs from the London area and publishing them as a kind of comic version of the kind of Erasmian epigram. But even there, you see him kind of gradually sneaking in religious and political material as the time goes on. And as you say, that they were phenomenally popular. You know, he did 100 and then another 100 and then a third 100, yet a fourth 100, 500s of epigrams. You know, cries of shut up in the back of the room, but no, 600. So when they actually published the works of John Hayward, what it was essentially the poetry and the epigrams. The plays didn't get a look in. Which is sobering, I think, in terms of his reputation in the mid-century.
And of course, then he wrote his or successively continued to write his epic, The Spider and the Fly. There is a show to do about The Spider and the Fly, which would feature bits of Spider and the Fly. I'm very interested in the narrative that you put forward of, you know, how it came into being, and because I think that's actually more interesting than the piece itself. You know, it sort of works until about what, chapter 50 or something, and then it goes somewhere completely different, and it's just fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether you know Spinal Tap, but there's that great moment when it all goes horribly wrong, and Nigel Tufnell has left the band, and the other two say, "Well, this is the moment to dust off Saucy Jack, Jack the Ripper musical," and I think The Spider and the Fly is Haywood's version of Saucy Jack. The first 50 chapters, read them in week, 50 chapters, is a kind of gentle satire of legal process. You know, what would happen if a fly got caught in a spider's web? How would he argue? Is it a case of trespass? Or is it burglary? You know, who has the right to try him? And you know, rib-ticklingly funny, presumably for Lincoln's Inn lawyers, for the first two or three chapters in the late 1520s. But you know, you can imagine him having to put it down and think, well, the moment is not right yet to launch this on my public. And then suddenly it becomes a rebellion. Spiders and flies go to war, and it's full of echoes of the popular rebellions under Edward. And you know, there's this thing of the Tree of Reformation, which was a thing in the Norfolk Revolt. Suddenly appears as a thing the spiders and the flies do. And it's clearly become a political satire. And you have endless chapters of argument about the rights of the people versus the responsibilities of governors. And then presumably he thought, oh no, it's still not working, is it? You know, no, I need something. And he puts it away for another 4 or 5 years. And then suddenly it's about Mary. What happens is, well, spoiler possibility?
I mean, I think we're okay. I think we're okay. I mean, the listeners can switch off now if they really just skip forward a couple of minutes.
If you want to know what happens to the spider and the fly in real time, don't listen to this. But you know, having argued forever about the spider and the fly, the maid comes in and with her broom sweeps the spider's web from the window and stamps on him. And then you have this kind of weird satirical treatment of the fall of the Earl of Northumberland as the great spider. And a long disquisition about how the maid in the poem and the maid, Queen Mary, are both the same and not the same. And how she will wield the broom of mercy and righteousness in the country again after the Edwardian Reformation. And so it's kind of weird part number three. It's like a upside down Christmas cake, or what do I mean, wedding cake with different colours and different shapes that he said, oh, here it is, done it, finished. And then presumably he persuaded some printer that this is the masterwork that he's got to invest his entire next year printing with all these extraordinary images and woodcuts of spiders and flies. Mm. And there's no evidence that anyone read it apart from, you know, 30 years later, people are ruminating about, and then there was this bloke who wrote this thing about a spider and a fly and no one knew what it was. So I imagine poor old Haywood going home and thinking, oh God, that's my masterpiece ruined. My public don't know me anymore. I'll do some more proverbs.
Hmm. It's, I keep coming back to it as something to adapt and play around with. And, you know, I certainly think the first half or could be turned into a nice little debate to play happily enough. And that functions perfectly well. But then I just have a weird live show with a jazz band and, you know, explosions and Foley and but also just commentary as we actually sort of pick up why it's so weird as we sort of just pick through bits of the text. And
that's the thing in a way. I mean, bits of it, any bit of it is quite interesting. You know, there are little vignettes, debates, arguments about one philosophical thing or another. Everyone is forever recapping and telling you what has happened. Get rid of all that. But I mean, if you took 100 lines from anywhere, they'd be quite interesting. It's just the fact that
there's so much of it.
Another million lines in which you have to survive. It doesn't work.
No. So as we go into, as I say, the very sad sort of final passage, I mean, with, you know, the difficulty of Mary's reign in the sense of expectation and what he gets. And then Elizabeth comes to the throne and it's all change, ding, ding, all over again. And having had to recant before, and the possibility that it's coming up again, he decides not to hang around.
Yep. I mean, like many of his relatives and compatriots, he decamps to the Netherlands and finds common cause with the Catholic community there. I found it really moving reading his final letters and accounts of him, because it clearly, when he left, and there is this brilliant poem discovered by Jane Flynn, which is about him seemingly saying farewell and taking stock of his life. It looks as if he expected to be there for a couple of years. He was an old man. He would die quietly and full of regret in a religious house in the Netherlands. But he lived on for another 15, 20 years. And these were not happy years. This was the years of the Great Dutch Revolt. So at least four times he moved from one place to another, in his 70s, fleeing persecution.
Yes, I mean the last sort of 50 pages of the book are very good, but they are also very, very sad. I mean, you go from the fun, shall we say, of Spider and the Fly, and we go into this narrative of from one place to another. Questions with his, where's he getting the money from? Because of course he's effectively disinherited from all his estates and livings in London, in England. Issues with his, his relationship with his sons, and
I'm glad you feel that, because in a way this is the first biography, probably the only biography I'll ever write, so I wanted to kind of give it a shape and to do him justice in those last chapters, and not to take out what must have been the stress and the strain and the pressure of that long period of exile. So I wanted to kind of end on a plaintive note, even though it's very easy to kind of cut to his deathbed and him doing a joke about being neither flesh nor fowl and thinking that the comedian leaves the stage. But it wasn't that simple. His modeling of himself as kind of the merry man in retirement was hard work for him, I think. And it was poignant. Or at least I found it that, and I wanted to get that across. So.
No, I definitely shut the book with if not a tear in my eye, but certainly as a sense of a great shame, really. He deserved to have sort of rusticated quietly, being terribly witty and a bit dottery, not to be chased up and down Europe.
People wanted to kill him.
So, I mean, you've stated it's quite a long book, but was there anything that didn't make the cut?
Gosh, I hope not. That would be... I'd have to do it all again with a director's cut version. No, I mean, I set myself, if there's anything at all in writing, I would write about it. And I would write about it with the same focus and commitment to it, even if it was rubbish. And I think some of his poems under Mary are rubbish. But I mean, they just are not very good. But I thought, do them. What interest is there for a reader, or for a historian, or for someone just interested in what? I mean, that's the abiding thing. What do you do when you're an entertainer whose market is taken away from you, or at least is threatened? How do you react to power when the truth you want to tell is difficult? And that's what's interesting about those poems, I think. He's misfiring because he's trying to tell a queen he loves and whose religion he shares that she shouldn't be killing Protestants. And that's that's something it's much more difficult to do that.
It was also, going back to the sort of first third half of the book, when we're talking about plays, which is an area I know much more about. The nice thing for me, having actually worked on the plays and knowing the plays really well, it was sort of like reading a book about a more famous author, and being able to sit there and go, well, I know all of these things. I can actually skip reading. I can skip reading through certain quotes because I know that passage. I know that passage very well. And it was, that's a very personal
You are my reader, Robert. You are he.
Well, I mean, you know, throwing back in the plug for the podcast itself, you know, you too can listen to and experience in some form the complete plays of John Heywood. And hopefully that makes anyone who picks up this book, which I can heartily recommend, all the more uneasy to do. I mean, you've worked on staging Play of the Weather yourself as well. So, and that is also available online. So there is more material out there. It's not like... Yep. They're just plays that you might have to try and pick up secondhand.
No, I think this is a brilliant synchronicity that you've been doing these plays so brilliantly at the same time as I was working on them. So I could listen to them myself. I could pick up bits and pieces. And anyone who thinks John Who can then go and listen to a few of these and think, yep, I knew I wouldn't like him. Or actually, probably more plausibly, that's really interesting. You know, he is much more experimental, much more a dramatist's dramatist than previous accounts would have it. You know, a lot of people talk about them as rather lumbering pieces of theatre. And I think that's because they haven't seen them performed. Mm. You know, once you hear them performed, once you see them performed, once you have them embodied and voiced, you see the craft much more obviously, I think.
There's a wide challenge about any sort of early Tudor drama, which is that, which you address in this book quite well, you know, that there is a lot to be mined from the original context, and that is a barrier. That is a genuine barrier for, you know, a lot of these plays are about ideas, not narrative. They're full of conventions. You could almost say court drama has that sort of pantomime element of the audience knows some of the conventions. Some of these plays are very similar to each other, not so much Heywood, but other court drama where the vice comes on and does this and then everyone gets drunk and looks for a sex worker. That has happened in so many interludes where it's all about a young person being drawn astray. And it's like you're waiting for that bit to happen and you're waiting for that, and there are expected audience responses. Heywood is actually quite different to quite a lot of other plays. I mean, there are other plays that do similar things. I wonder if that's a Restall thing as well, you know, considering the four elements is basically a science lecture.
Restall is didactic in a different way, I think, but most of these kind of moral interludes are trying to teach us how to live. And Heywood just isn't interested in teaching people how to live. He wants them to think, I think, and say, well, what about this? And what about the other? He at no point does he give a play that tells you what to do. He shows people doing things wrong and arguing about it and rogues, and that's... Yeah, no one goes to hell. No one is saved.
It's so modern in the sense that you are left to... There's enough room for manoeuvre to say that most of the time nobody wins an argument. You know, they all look, they all sort of agree to disagree most of the time. You are invited to... I think that's why Gentleness and Ability keeps drawing me in, because it keeps not ending.
Yes.
And it keeps sort of, it's like they can't not reiterate their own points
and that's the other thing, I think, you know, it comes out of and plays into that culture of grammar school and law court argument. You know, they love a good argument. No, they don't. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. You know, there's that kind of delight that you know what an argument looks like, and then you see a good one and then you see a bad one. And they'll keep endlessly coming back and say, and another thing, you know, when I said that, I also meant this. And that's part of the, you know, the audience knew what that was as well, and they liked it. And we've definitely lost that. I mean, the idea of a kind of argument as a pastime is as a very early Tudor thing.
Well, certainly not argument that isn't very binary, which is, I think, what the modern world and modern social media does to arguing is it's shouting from a distance in a very binary way. And though there's a little bit of, I mean, you could argue that's what Pardon of the Friar is. Actually, but it's Twitter.
Yes. Yeah, that's his most binary.
Oh, there's a thought. So yeah, that's the joy. I mean, I desperately would like to be in a position where we could be performing more John Hayward, playing around with the work as well as in context, but also seeing, you know, can we stress test it and see what material comes out of it.
I think that's what he would have wanted, if I'm not parodying Trump. If Hayward were looking down on us, he would want us to be still messing about with the stuff, not, you know, using it as a means of making theatre and making people laugh. I mean, that's, you know, his self-image, I think I say somewhere in the book, is, you know, not as the artist, but as the good companion, the person who will make merry with you. So as long as we're still making merry with him, I think he'd be all right.
Yes. Well, I'd just like to. I think we've covered the general shape of everything.
Killed him off.
We've reached the end of his life. So that I can heartily recommend John Hayward, Comedy and Survival in Tudor England. It's published by Oxford University Press. It is available from your favourite online retailer, and maybe soon from an actual shop.
Let's hope. If you want a discount, hit me up privately. I have a code.
Oh, you have a code. You don't want to say that too loudly. Then everyone
I think you'll find I didn't say that.
But all that remains is to thank Professor Greg Walker for talking with us today, and we will be back with the podcast very soon.
Thanks for having me.